I'm sure everybody is curious as to why this happened, why this defendant is involved with a 12-year-old little boy, and I can't answer that right now.
As Christmas drew near in 2010, detectives in Houston, Texas, received an alert about a missing 12-year-old boy. As they launched their investigation, conflicting accounts of events surfaced from those who were closest to the boy. In the hustle and bustle of the early morning at a meat market in Houston, Texas, cashier Angela Davis prepared for a hectic Christmas Eve shift in 2010. As Angela worked, her mind was split between managing the holiday rush and the excitement brewing at home. Her 12-year-old son, Jonathan Foster, was looking forward to opening up his Christmas presents the next morning. It was the first Christmas that Angela would be spending with her son in 6 years. When Jonathan was just a young boy, Angela had found herself struggling with drug addiction, and he had been sent to live with his uncle. Angela and Jonathan shared their home with Sharon Enamorado, a friend who often looked after Jonathan while Angela worked. At about 1:45 p.m., a phone call came in to Angela's work. One of her colleagues, Norma Suarez, picked up.
The phone rang. It was her son. He said that he needed to talk to his mom. I looked out, and I seen we had a line. And I said, there's no way I can get her. So I'm hearing another lady background.
Was there anything distinctive about her voice?
She was kind of angry. And I said, look, ma'am, I'm trying to help you. She said, I don't give up. She said some dirty words.
The phone call appeared to be from Jonathan, but an angry-sounding woman could be heard in the background. The woman then took over the phone from Jonathan and demanded to speak with Angela. By this point, Angela's supervisor, Lewis Smith, had taken over the phone call. She tried to reason with the caller, but she insisted on getting in touch with Angela. The woman said that she immediately needed Angela to provide her with Sharon's phone number. Before Lewis even had a chance to respond, the woman threatened, "If you don't get her now, something's going to happen. He won't be here for long." Lewis knew that Angela's son, Jonathan, had just come to live with her, and she feared for his safety. She promised the unfamiliar caller that she would find Angela and immediately hand the phone over to her. However, when Angela finally picked up, the mysterious woman had hung up. Angela frantically called back, but was met with an endless ringing tone. After what seemed like an eternity, somebody finally picked up the phone. It was a woman with a raspy voice, which didn't sound familiar to Angela at all. Angela identified herself as Jonathan's mother and asked whether he was home and who she was. In the background, Angela overheard the woman asking her son, "Is Angela your mother?" Jonathan softly responded, "Yes, ma'am, Angela's my mother." The call then abruptly ended. Jonathan Foster was born in Houston, Texas, on the 9th of November 1998, to Angela Davis and Richard Foster. Angela fondly recalled that as a newborn, he would pull his legs up to his chest and straighten them out like a frog, earning him the nickname Frog from his aunt on the spot. Unfortunately, Angela and Richard's relationship quickly deteriorated, leading to Richard abandoning the family. Jonathan was merely 4 years old when he last saw his father, leaving Angela to navigate single parenthood alone. Despite her efforts, Angela faced numerous challenges and went through several marriages and divorces over the next couple of years. As Angela struggled, the situation took a darker turn when she encountered legal troubles. These resulted in her arrest on a minor drug charge and a probation violation. This tumultuous period prompted Child Protective Services to intervene, investigating allegations of physical abuse and neglect concerning Jonathan and his half-sister, who was 2 years younger. Following their investigation, Child Protective Services closed down the case after determining that Jonathan and his sister were not directly under Angela's care at the time. After enduring challenges, Jonathan and his half-sister found solace in the care of his uncle, Glenn Shrimsher. They easily settled into a stable life on his farm in Missouri, where Jonathan enjoyed his days immersed in a nurturing environment. He formed deep connections with his five cousins, engaged in activities such as growing watermelon, riding dirt bikes and fishing. He also enjoyed playing basketball, going to museums and watching the History Channel. A special bond developed between Jonathan and the family's horse, Valentino, and he enjoyed frequent visits with his grandparents. However, his mother, Angela, remained largely absent from his life, visiting only once over the next 5 years. Glenn was a pillar of support for Jonathan, and fondly said of him, "He was just so sweet and submissive, always looking for a hug." Then in November of 2009, Jonathan's grandmother, Mary Gifford, called for him to come and live with her in Houston so that he could be closer to his mother. Glenn was absolutely heartbroken, but he recognized the importance of family bond and understood the necessity of the move. So Jonathan moved back to Houston, and the bond between him and his grandmother, Mary, deepened. Mary recalled how Jonathan had a kind spirit. She said that when he loved you. After a month of living with his grandmother, Jonathan asked if he could move in with his mother. He hadn't lived with her since he was 6 years old, but by now, Angela was working a steady job at the meat market, and she was ready to take care of her son. Mary recollected, "We talked about him going to live with his mother. That's when he said that was his wish for his birthday. He was really, really happy. He was flourishing. He was complete." In the gritty confines of the Northwest Houston pocket in Garden Oaks, Angela Davis and her new husband, David Davis, had carved out a life in their rented apartment. In December of 2010, Jonathan moved in with them. He was enrolled at Durham Elementary School, where he quickly caught the attention of the principal, who praised his brightness and sweetness. His compassionate nature shone through as he befriended a classmate with no friends. Angela fondly recalled of him. "He was always trying to help somebody. He felt like he was a man because he fixed a little girl's bicycle chain." Yet the optimism of this family reunion soon turned sour. Angela and David's relationship had been fraught with tension, marked by David's violent outbursts when fueled by alcohol. During one incident, David hit Angela so hard that she needed to seek out treatment at the hospital. The volatile environment escalated when, just weeks after Jonathan arrived, David slapped him. Angela immediately took action. She gathered their belongings and sought refuge at the apartment of her friend, Sharon Enamorado, which was located conveniently nearby. This new living arrangement offered Angela a lifeline, allowing Sharon to provide occasional care for Jonathan while she worked. After receiving the cryptic phone call at work, Angela's world abruptly shifted. She abandoned her duties for the day and hopped on her motor scooter and raced towards the apartment. About 100 yards from the front door, her scooter sputtered and stalled, leaving her no choice but to sprint the remainder of the distance on foot. Fumbling with her keys, Angela swung open the front door, a sense of dread tightening in her chest. She called out for Jonathan, but the apartment echoed eerily with the blare of cartoons on the television and the hum of a video game on the computer screen. However, Jonathan was nowhere to be found, and the cordless home phone had vanished along with him. The apartment held a silent testimony to Jonathan's abrupt disappearance. A half-filled glass of cold milk stood on the kitchen table, accompanied by a tin box of Tootsie Rolls, which was the chosen pre-Christmas treat. Yet there was no hint of a struggle, only the absence of some of Jonathan's belongings. A tan t-shirt adorned with a guitar, a pair of jeans, white sneakers, and his cherished black stuffed cat, which had been crafted by his grandmother. Fueled by panic, Angela meticulously combed through the apartment, finding no trace of her son. She ran back outside and searched throughout the apartment complex, but her hope dwindled as realization struck that Jonathan wasn't playing a game of hide-and-seek. Angela then returned to the apartment and reported her son as missing. Many people are often surprised to discover the diverse audience of older women that tune into Morbidology each week. Today, our sponsor, Winona, caters specifically to this demographic. Designed for women navigating menopause or perimenopause, Winona is a network of OBGYN health professionals dedicated to acknowledging and addressing your symptoms seriously. They provide physician-prescribed bioidentical hormone replacement therapy, also known as HRT, through a user-friendly network of in-state doctors, simplifying the initiation of HRT. Winona's bioidentical HRT employs plant-based hormones aligning with your body's natural rhythm to alleviate hot flashes, weight gain, and other symptoms. Remarkably, 80% of Winona's users experience relief within just 90 days. Visit buywinona.com to start your free trial. With free US shipping and the ability to pause or cancel any time, your path to wellness has zero obligations. Use the code Morbidology at buywinona.com for 25% off your first order. That is buywinona.com/morbidology. As soon as the news of Jonathan's disappearance reached the detectives, they descended upon Angela's apartment. She recounted the morning and afternoon's events to the detectives. According to Angela, Jonathan had been at home with Sharon, but had left to fetch some video games from David's apartment, which was just a short distance away. She told detectives about the strange phone call she had received at work, and said that there appeared to be an unfamiliar woman with Jonathan. She assured detectives that the voice on the phone wasn't her roommate Sharon. The search for Jonathan kicked off immediately, with detectives scouring through the area between the two apartments. As the initial efforts yielded no signs of the missing boy, the investigation expanded. Detectives ventured into the woodland, traced the train tracks, and appealed to the public for assistance, unsure if Jonathan had wandered off or if something nefarious had taken place. A police source commented to the Houston Chronicle, "I don't know if it's an abduction. I don't know if he just walked off. I don't know if there's foul play involved. We have no reason to think he's a runaway." Jonathan's grandmother, Mary, issued a public plea, urging him to hold on while the family worked tirelessly to find him. Mary shared concerns about Jonathan's attention deficit disorder, expressing a deep desire for his safe return. Her apprehension swirled into fears that somebody had taken him against his will. As the sun set that evening, Texas EquiSearch joined the quest for Jonathan, combing through the area with determination. As detectives delved deeper into Jonathan's disappearance, a web of deception began to unravel. Angela's initial narrative had been carefully crafted to shield her from judgment. When detectives spoke with Sharon and David, they learned that Sharon wasn't at home babysitting Jonathan that day. Instead, Jonathan had been home alone. Fearing the judgment of others, Angela admitted to making the story up. She thought that Jonathan would be found immediately and didn't want people to judge her as a bad mother for leaving her son home alone. David then told detectives that at about 1:30 p.m. that day, he went to Angela's apartment to check in on Jonathan.
It was about 1:30. I said, I'd go check on him and see how excited he was for Christmas. I knocked on the door. Who is it? This is Dad. He peered out the window just to check, you know. He's just all excited to see me, and about Christmas. He's playing a game on the computer.
And he asked you if you wanted to play?
Mm-hmm.
And did you?
No. I just so wish that I had stayed and played that game with him.
So you hugged him and told him to sit tight, see him in a little bit. He closed and locked the door behind you.
Yeah, it's just breaking my heart, and I'm the last one that's on.
He said that Jonathan was engrossed in video games on the computer, seemingly alone, and that everything appeared to be normal. When Angela's true statement hit the public eye, remorse and self-blame consumed her. She said to the Houston Chronicle, "I feel responsible because I left him here. I'm his mama. I'm supposed to protect him. Who else is going to protect him if I can't?" As Angela anxiously awaited Jonathan's return, an unexpected visitor knocked on her front door later that night. When she opened it, an unfamiliar woman stood before her. It was Mona Nelson, a friend of her roommate Sharon. Mona told Angela that she had popped over to the apartment earlier that afternoon and had knocked on the front door. She said that Jonathan opened up the door shirtless, and there appeared to be somebody else inside the apartment with him. Angela immediately told detectives about this new tidbit of information, and it piqued their attention. They began to consider the possibility that the person at the apartment with Jonathan wasn't a stranger, but instead somebody familiar. According to Mona, Jonathan didn't appear to be in distress. Turning their attention to Angela's husband, David, detectives unearthed the troubling history. Just 10 days before Jonathan had vanished, David had violently slapped him, prompting Angela to flee with her son. David spoke with detectives about this incident.
Let's go back here to the 14th. What Angela says is that you and Jonathan had some sort of a conflict and that you hit Jonathan.
He's really a crybaby, whatever, so he told his mom that I smacked him. Doesn't act like a 12-year-old. Mm-hmm. He acts a lot younger. Mm-hmm. We never slap a child across the face.
Listen to me. I married a woman who had 2 children, so I was stepfather for a while. I understand the complexities of a mixed family.
Right, right.
Believe me.
Yeah, join the family. I didn't have so much with him. I mean, it's her.
Well, right.
She flies
right
off the wall.
David's demeanor during the investigation raised some eyebrows, as he casually referred to Jonathan as a crybaby and expressed his frustration from babysitting him. These callous remarks struck an odd chord, especially given the gravity of Jonathan's disappearance.
You popped him. Now, whether you slapped him, whether you docked his hat, whether whatever you did, it really, it's irrelevant. The point was, what you laid hands on her 12-year-old little boy. She didn't like it. She says, "I'm leaving you. Divorce is the only answer." And she goes down to Sharon's.
Anytime she gets mad, she's done it 4 times.
Okay.
David maintained that despite the issues at home, he loved Jonathan.
And I went out and bought him a new electric scooter, bought him a bicycle, mm-hmm. and, I helped him with his homework.
Detectives, however, weren't really buying David's story.
Look at me. I want you to understand this. And you're sitting here now putting on this show for me to cover your own ass, that all this business about how much you love Jonathan and how much you love Angela, it's all because the only person that you love is yourself. All roads are leading to you. I mean, there's just no dispute in it.
Well, I can't find him. I wouldn't do nothing to that boy. He can scream at you, blue in the face, whatever. I didn't do anything to hurt him.
A theory began to take shape. Did David hold a grudge against Jonathan for the breakdown of his marriage? The possibility of David's involvement in Jonathan's disappearance loomed large, and a police source articulated the chilling reality by stating, "Unfortunately in life, often it's not the strangers who we have to fear. It's the people we know that probably pose the most danger to us, and that can be friends, neighbours, whatever." This unsettling theory echoed through Jonathan's family, and even among some neighbours who found it difficult to dismiss. Jonathan's grandmother, Mary, reinforced the suspicions when she spoke with detectives.
Angela has this thing, breaking up, going back, breaking up, going back, breaking up, going back. And then I get a phone call from my daughter saying she's moving in with Sharon because David had slapped Jonathan and knocked him to the floor.
She said that she hadn't trusted David from the very beginning. However, detectives hit a roadblock when David provided an alibi. He claimed he had visited Jonathan that afternoon to check up on him and then headed to the Catty Corner Ice House in Wakefield, a local bar. Detectives were determined to verify David's alibi, so they scrutinized surveillance footage from the bar. The footage revealed David at the bar from 2 p.m. until 3:30 p.m., effectively eliminating him from the investigation.
Oh, they drilled me like I thought I was in Vietnam, baby, but, you know, I know that's your job. You know, it's you, they kept saying, I love my boy.
As the search for Jonathan intensified, an unsettling question lingered. Who, if not David, was responsible for his disappearance? After several days passed without any sign of Jonathan and no clues about his whereabouts, detectives decided to issue an Amber Alert. Detectives were now sure that Jonathan was the victim of foul play and had most likely been abducted from the apartment. The next morning, at about 9:30 a.m., a man was driving along the road near East Hardy Toll Road. This was approximately 10 miles from Jonathan's last known location at home. While glancing out of his window, something in a ditch running alongside the road caught his attention. It appeared to be black, and it was smouldering. Concerned it might be the burned remains of an unwanted animal, the man pulled over to investigate. Upon closer inspection, he realized that the object wasn't an animal, but the charred body of a child, rendered unrecognizable by the extensive burning. Intermingled with the body was burned carpet and twine, which was wrapped around the wrists. Disturbed by the discovery, the man promptly contacted police, who responded to the scene within minutes. The road was sealed off, and crime scene tape went up before forensic experts were summoned. Upon surveying the crime scene, it became apparent that the child had suffered a violent death and had been burned elsewhere before being discarded at the current location. While detectives were already aware of Jonathan's disappearance, there were other missing children in the area. Moreover, detectives said that the child appeared to be approximately 3 feet tall, prompting them to await a formal identification. Though a burned body may experience a slight reduction in height due to tissue contraction, a 2-foot loss seemed excessive, and Jonathan was almost 5 feet tall. Following the meticulous examination by crime scene investigators and forensic experts, the small body was transported to the medical examiner's office. That afternoon, even before an official identification had been made, the disturbing discovery made its way to local headlines. News outlets reported that the child measured around 3 feet in height, temporarily alleviating concerns that it might be Jonathan. Regardless of the identity, the finding was undeniably heart-wrenching. While the autopsy was being conducted, Sergeant Brian Harris commented to the public, "The finding of a body kind of confirmed our worst fears." When considering drugs, the common perception tends to carry negative associations. MindMend, however, is on a mission to redefine that narrative with their transformative magic mushrooms. Born out of Canada's deepening mental health crisis and dissatisfaction with traditional pharmaceuticals, MindMend collaborates closely with local farmers in Vancouver to cultivate top-tier, eco-conscious and organic psychedelic mushrooms. Available in capsules, gummies or tinctures, MindMend's carefully dosed products cater to both beginners and experienced users alike. Their offerings extend beyond mere consumption. MindMend's products serve as a gateway to reshaping connections with oneself, others, and the planet. By prioritizing quality, sustainability, and accessibility, they are paving the way for a positive shift in the perception of psychedelic substances. Ready to embark on a transformative journey? Visit mindmend.co and use the promo code Morbidology for an exclusive 15% discount on your order. Meanwhile, detectives continued in their search for Jonathan, in tandem with searching for where the unidentified child may have been burned. As the investigation unfolded, a candlelight vigil took place that night at Garden Oaks Baptist Church. Around 200 people attended, gathering to pray for Jonathan's safe return home. During the service, Jonathan's grandmother, Mary, expressed, "I've had my faith tested in many, many ways, but this is really testing it." Tragically, the very next day, the family received the devastating news that the burned body was in fact Jonathan. Due to the extensive burning, he could only be identified via dental records. The initial reports of the body being 3 feet tall were found to be inaccurate, as they had been estimated visually. The extensive burning also meant that a cause of death for Jonathan couldn't be determined. However, the pathologist noted that there were no external injuries, such as stab wounds or gunshot wounds. He further said that Jonathan appeared to have been burned from head to toe with something such as a blowtorch. There was no evidence of any kind of accelerant being used. One grim theory began to formulate that Jonathan had been tortured to death with a blowtorch. As detectives continued in their investigation, they turned their attention to the surveillance footage from various businesses close to where Jonathan's body had been found. They discovered that an office building covered the ditch, and when they analysed it, they saw that at 6 p.m. on the day Jonathan disappeared, a silver pickup truck pulled up alongside the road. A black woman emerged from the pickup truck, and detectives couldn't help but notice she bore striking similarities to 44-year-old Mona Nelson, Sharon's friend who told Angela she had called by the apartment before Jonathan disappeared. In the grainy footage, the woman got out of the car, approached the truck bed, and lifted out some kind of object. She then carried the object to the very ditch where Jonathan's lifeless body had been found. Detectives soon learned that Mona Nelson drove a silver Ford F-150 pickup truck that looked similar to the one seen in the surveillance video. Furthermore, some of Angela's neighbours reported seeing her vehicle outside Angela's home around the same time that Jonathan disappeared. Detectives immediately made their way to Nelson's apartment and brought her in to be interviewed.
My partner, Phil, I'm calling.
How are you doing?
When did you see the little boy last?
I got in town around 12:30, 1 o'clock, knocked on the door, and Jonathan told me that Sharon's not home.
You're at Sharon's house at around 2 o'clock in the afternoon because that witness across the street sees you go into Sharon's house. He sees you come out. He sees Angela come up right after you've pulled off.
I did not harm that little boy. I wouldn't do it.
Nelson was then confronted with the surveillance footage, but she denied that it was her.
How do we explain your truck being caught on camera?
I don't know.
Mona, let's cut the BS, all right?
My truck was with me all day, and I was not on Hardy Street.
To try and get more information, detectives showed Nelson the gruesome photographs of Jonathan's burned body.
Oh, my God.
Look at it.
Oh, my God. That's Jonathan?
Yes.
That's sad. He didn't deserve that.
It's more than sad. Sad doesn't even begin to define that. That's evil, is what that is. Jonathan didn't deserve it, didn't ask for it.
Despite her denials, Nelson opted to cooperate, and she granted detectives permission to search her silver pickup truck and her apartment, which was located 3 miles away from where Jonathan's body had been found. Detectives and forensic experts immediately zeroed in on Mona Nelson's apartment. In the trash outside, they came across an assortment of evidence. Intermingled in the trash, they found burned carpet fragments that looked to be a match to the scorched fibres discovered with Jonathan's body. Twine in the trash also looked similar to the restraints that had bound Jonathan's wrists. A grey sweatshirt adorned with Looney Tunes characters was discovered in the trash as well, and Angela identified it as belonging to her son. There were some bloodstains on the back of it, which when tested, proved to contain Nelson's DNA. Inside Angela's apartment, detectives also stumbled upon welding torches. According to the pathologist, the burns to Jonathan's body could have been caused by such an item. The ominous findings gave way to a theory that began to formulate among the detectives. They speculated that Nelson had descended upon Angela and Jonathan's apartment that afternoon in search of Sharon. However, something along the way went wrong and resulted in Jonathan being abducted, taken to Nelson's apartment, and then killed. When Mona Nelson was confronted with the evidence against her, she changed her story in the interrogation room. She admitted that it was her pickup truck captured on the surveillance footage, and that it was her disposing of Jonathan's body. However, she refused to say whether or not she had killed Jonathan. After several more hours of interrogation, Nelson once more changed her story.
I was headed up towards Shepherd Street, and David flagged me down. And he asked me, "You have a truck? I need to move some stuff." David says to pull in here. I jump out, manhandle it like here, and it goes over. I didn't harm Jonathan, and I had no idea that that was Jonathan.
She claimed that she was drunk that day, and that David Davis, Jonathan's stepfather, had paid her $20 to dispose of a closed container, which she believed was filled with trash. However, the grim reality at the crime scene contradicted her story. When Jonathan's body was discovered, it wasn't inside any container. Mona Nelson's life unfolded against a backdrop of stark contrasts, marked by a tumultuous journey through the highs and lows of circumstance. Born on the 5th of March 1966, she was the youngest among nine siblings to Mary Preston, a dedicated elementary school teacher, and James Russo, a mortician. Navigating the Houston area school system, Nelson's academic journey yielded B and C grades. However, the 11th grade marked a turning point as she dropped out of Bel Air High School, opting to secure her GED at Houston Community College. At the age of 15, she ventured out into the world, crossing paths with her future husband, Michael Nelson, just before her 16th birthday. Their union unfolded rapidly, with Nelson and Michael exchanging vows on the 7th of May, 1983. The bride, a mere 17 years old, stood beside her 28-year-old groom. Just 2 months later, the couple welcomed premature twins, a boy and girl, into the world. Life took an unexpected twist as Nelson settled into a home owned by her father-in-law, Clyde Nelson, a man stained by a dark past. Clyde was a convicted sex offender who had just been sentenced to 30 years for sexually assaulting a 5-year-old girl. Struggling on a meager $900 monthly income from Michael's carpentry work, the family weathered challenging circumstances. In the early 1980s, Nelson briefly ventured into a summer job at the Martin Luther King Center in Houston, where she contributed to clerical duties and recreational activities. Over time, her path diverged from Michael, and she found love with a woman named Anita Morris. Their relationship spanned a decade, during which they nurtured Anita's children in the heart of East Texas. Meanwhile, Nelson's own children found a home with their father. Sporting an imposing stature of nearly 5'11" and tipping the scales at over 225 pounds, Nelson soon discovered her passion in the women's boxing circuit, where she fought under the name Iron Fist. However, Nelson's life was checkered with run-ins with law enforcement. In 1984, she was charged with aggravated robbery and pleaded guilty in exchange for 10 years probation. She had told detectives that a man had forced her into the robbery, and she feared he would hurt her if she didn't comply. Then in 1991, her probation was revoked after she was arrested for trafficking Mexican nationals for $600 apiece. She was sent back to prison and served just over 3 years. Then in 1997, Nelson pleaded guilty and served 30 days in jail for a bad check charge in Dangerfield in East Texas. In 2001, Nelson was arrested and accused of assaulting her girlfriend, Danita, and three neighborhood children that she was babysitting, but Danita dropped the charges. She later said of Nelson, "She's always been there for me and my kids, no matter what." Just the next year, Nelson spent another 30 days in jail in McKinney, a Dallas suburb, after pleading guilty to a marijuana charge. 3 years later, she spent 2 months in jail and a year on probation for making a terroristic threat to another woman and misdemeanor criminal mischief in Mount Vernon. She served 1 year probation and 2 months in jail. Most recently, in 2008, Nelson was arrested after her daughter Ava was found with a black eye and bloody face, but she declined to press charges. In the year preceding Nelson's arrest, she worked as a handyman for a management company that took care of odd jobs at various apartment complexes. This included the Tiffany Oaks apartments, just across the street from where Jonathan, Angela, and Sharon lived. She also moonlit as a welder and collected scrap metal at the various apartment complexes, where she was allowed to keep half of what she earned for it. On the 29th of December, Mona Nelson was charged with the capital murder of Jonathan Foster. Detective Michael Miller, who was wearied by 14 years in the homicide department, somberly declared, "She acted alone in this crime of her own disregard for human life. She decided to take Jonathan Foster out of our world. I've worked in the homicide division for 14 years, and this is the worst case that I've ever been a part of. An innocent 12-year-old boy who was described by all as happy, outgoing, and well-liked in the neighborhood. Certainly, it's an absolute tragedy." Jonathan's uncle, Glenn, echoed the sentiments of the mourning community, stating, "He didn't get to live his life. She took his life for her own pleasure. I don't know how else to put it. I hope she finds it in her heart to ask the Lord to forgive her for what she's done." As the year turned, Garden Oaks Baptist Church was filled to the brim as hundreds of mourners turned out for Jonathan's funeral on the 4th of January. Pastor Ken Durham presided over the service and painted a poignant picture of Jonathan and urged those present to emulate his profound capacity for love. In a heartfelt eulogy, Glenn struggled to contain his grief as he described Jonathan as more like a son. Reading aloud a letter he had penned for Jonathan, Glenn's voice wavered with emotion as he said, "I want to start out by saying how much I love you and to thank you for being here for me when I need you. You made myself and my life better in ways I didn't realize you would." The weight of sorrow enveloped the space as Glenn fought to conclude his poignant letter. Jonathan's grandmother, Mary, grappled with regret, lamenting the moment when Jonathan was returned to his mother. She questioned, "We all have guilt. Why weren't we able to save this little boy?" Both Angela and David were seated in the front row, but they said that they were too overcome with grief to speak about Jonathan. In the midst of sorrow, one of Jonathan's classmates, Victoria Pallares, bravely broached a question that lingered in the hearts and minds of everybody present. "I can't understand why they would hurt such a boy." That question still hadn't been answered, but it was on everybody's lips. Following the service, Jonathan was buried in the South Park Cemetery in Pearland, in a family plot that would someday hold his grandparents. In the aftermath of Jonathan's funeral service, detectives announced that they were delving into the prospect that Nelson might be involved in other cases of missing children in the area. The sheer randomness and senselessness of Jonathan's murder prompted them to consider a haunting question. Had she committed a similar act before? Michael Miller, a seasoned figure in the Houston Police Department, cast a shadow of suspicion over Nelson's past, asserting, "Do I believe she's done it before? Yeah, I do. I don't think that she began and ended with the abduction of Jonathan Foster. I don't." Meanwhile, local activist Quinnell X challenged the narrative of Nelson acting alone in Jonathan's abduction and murder. Drawing from conversations with Nelson, he questioned the motivations behind a seemingly random act and questioned whether somebody else may have been involved. Quinnell X is a civil rights activist who gained prominence in the early 2000s as a spokesperson and leader of the New Black Panther Party, which was not the successor of the Black Panther Party. He's a polarizing figure whose methods and statements sparked both support and criticism. He shared his belief that there was some kind of drug debt involved in the murder, and that he believed Nelson was protecting somebody.
There's more to this, and I think the stepfather needs to step up to the plate and be absolutely honest and tell the truth, because he knows more, I believe, than what he is saying, based on my communication with Miss Nelson.
The investigation so far had actually unveiled some troubling details about Nelson's friend, Sharon. She had a felony drug record, and after Jonathan's murder, she faced eviction from the shared apartment, which raised suspicions of a drug-related connection. Rumors swirled, suggesting that Nelson had gone to the apartment that day in search of drugs. Quite possibly, Jonathan was just at the wrong place at the wrong time, and was inadvertently put in the path of an angry woman in search of drugs.
Ah, Asia, the land of contrast. So mysterious, so diverse, so peaceful, so safe. But seriously, is that how it really is? While Asia is 100% filled with amazing people, culture, food, and landscape, it is also home to crazy legends, superstitions, and of course, atrocious crimes. The Asian Madness podcast covers a wide variety of topics, ranging from silly weird things to unimaginable horrors. Why is a murder case nicknamed the Hello Kitty murder? Why do people avoid picking up random red envelopes on the streets? And who are the most infamous serial killers you've probably never heard of from Asia? If any of that sounds interesting, search for and subscribe to the Asian Madness podcast on your favorite podcast app.
Detectives touched on the possibility that somebody else was involved, but noted that there was an abundance of evidence found inside Nelson's apartment, inside her truck, and in the trash. Furthermore, nobody else was captured on the surveillance footage, and it was a woman's voice who Angela heard on the telephone shortly before her son disappeared. Despite this, detectives said that they were looking into the possibility that Nelson had an accomplice. Then on the 4th of January, Nelson made her first court appearance, where she was appraised of her rights and appointed Alan Tanner as her defense attorney. After she left the courtroom, defense attorney Tanner returned and said to the judge that as she left, she burst into tears. He commented, "She cried her eyes out. She's not the stone-cold mean woman like the cops have made out." In the wake of Mona Nelson's arrest, a handful of other people came to her defense. Among the staunch defenders was her sister, Angie Johnson, who rejected the notion that she could commit such a monstrous act against a child. Angie painted a portrait of Nelson as a mother and a grandmother of five, with one grandchild the same age as Jonathan. She recounted how on Christmas Day, Nelson was jolted awake by a news report on Jonathan's disappearance. She vividly recalled Nelson uttering, "I know these people." She said that Nelson seemed surprised, but that didn't really align with the time frame. Nelson had already approached Angela and told her that she had seen Jonathan shortly before he disappeared. She was obviously already well aware that he was missing. Nelson's mother, Mary Lee Preston, joined the defense by asserting her daughter's innocence. Both women highlighted that Nelson didn't appear to be nervous in the days following Jonathan's disappearance. Instead, she appeared to be concerned about money. Just after Christmas, Nelson got a $20 advance from her boss so that she could put fuel in her car, and told her daughter Ava that she couldn't come and visit because she couldn't afford the travel. The absence of a clear motive lingered, as a perplexing piece of the puzzle for detectives. The murder of Jonathan was extremely brutal, and detectives still couldn't figure out a potential motivation. Prosecutor Connie Spence remarked,
"I'm sure everybody is curious as to why this happened, why this defendant is involved with a 12-year-old little boy, and I can't answer that right now."
As the legal drama unfolded, Nelson opted for a bench trial. She thrust her fate into the hands of a singular judge, who would play the dual role of judge and jury. If convicted, Mona Nelson would be looking at a life sentence without the possibility of parole. In August 2013, Nelson's defense team sought to have her statements thrown out of evidence, claiming that they were coerced. She claimed that she had only made the statements because she wanted to go home and go to a doctor because she felt sick. When she was ultimately examined by doctors, they couldn't find anything wrong with her. State District Judge Janine Barr ultimately denied the request and said the prosecutors were allowed to enter Nelson's statements into evidence. The murder trial began on the 14th of August, and during opening statements, Prosecutor Connie Spence stated,
"We had the defendant taking Jonathan, and between 2:15 and 6:08, she killed him."
She continued, telling the courtroom and the judge, "The big question that everyone has in this case is the why, the motive behind this case, and there's not going to be a motive. You're not going to hear any evidence of that. I'm going to tell you the what the evidence will prove." It was the prosecution's theory that Nelson was drunk on Christmas Eve and became angry when she went to Sharon's home, but Jonathan wouldn't let her in because he'd been instructed by his mother not to let anybody in. They speculated that she barged her way in and demanded to know Sharon's phone number before taking off with Jonathan and ultimately killing him. Defense attorney Alan Tanner also touched on a lack of motive, telling the judge, "Mona Nelson had absolutely zero motive to kill Jonathan Foster. They searched and searched and searched for a motive, but there's no reason why she would have killed that boy." He touched on the rocky relationship between Angela and David, and suggested that David would have had the motivation to get rid of Jonathan. He stated, "He wanted to get her back, and he told people at work that Jonathan is the root of all his problems." The first witness of the trial was Jonathan's mother, Angela, who spoke about the strange phone call she received that morning, where a woman could be heard speaking to her son. She testified that she had never met Mona Nelson before she came to her apartment that night, to claim she had called by earlier and Jonathan had answered the door. She said that later she found out that Nelson was a drinking buddy of her roommate Sharon, who had invited her over for Christmas Eve dinner. It was revealed that the two supervisors who spoke with the unfamiliar woman on the phone that afternoon at work had described the caller as a white woman. Nelson's defense attorney touched on this and pointed out that Nelson was obviously a black woman. Her testimony was followed by David, who said that despite the claims of abuse, he had loved Jonathan like his own son. He told the judge, "Jonathan asked if he could call me dad, and I felt honored. I was excited. He was a happy little boy." According to David, he was excited to become a father to a son at the age of 55, after he had raised three girls. He admitted to telling detectives that he was tired of babysitting Jonathan and that he called him a crybaby. He said that despite this, he did actually enjoy looking after Jonathan after school, and said that they went on daily bike rides together. The prosecution then presented video surveillance of David at a local bar from 2 p.m. until 3:30 p.m., which was the critical time frame in which Jonathan had vanished. However, the defense team hit back and claimed that the mechanism stamping the time and date on the surveillance recording was way off. They said that it had to be manually reconfigured, and that the true time David was at the bar was unknown. Testimony then shifted to the physical evidence, with Detective Roger Chappelle testifying about the Looney Tunes sweatshirt found in trash outside Nelson's home. He informed the judge that the blood spattered on the back had come back as a match to Nelson. He also testified about the burned carpet and twine, and said that a cadaver dog indicated had the scent of a dead body. The detective mentioned the welding equipment found inside Nelson's apartment, and said that the burns to Jonathan appeared to have been carried out with such an item. Nelson's defense attorney then refuted some of the physical evidence. While the prosecution maintained that the carpet and twine found inside the trash matched that what was found with Jonathan's body, the defense said that it didn't match. Moreover, defense attorney Tanner pointed out that none of Jonathan's DNA was discovered in Nelson's pickup truck. This, however, didn't correlate with Nelson's own statements. She had eventually admitted to detectives that it was her on surveillance dumping Jonathan's body. After a 2-week trial, both the prosecution and defense rested. During the closing arguments, defense attorney Allen touched on Nelson's statements to detectives, telling the judge. In the first three, she said that she did not dump the body. In the last one, she said that she did. Granted, and I'll eat that she lied about that in her first three statements, but that doesn't mean that she killed the child or kidnapped the child. That does not make her guilty of capital murder. He said of the forensic evidence in the case, it's just not there, and said that the prosecution had failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Nelson had killed Jonathan. Prosecutor Connie Spence refuted this during her closing arguments, telling the judge, the evidence leads to one person only, and that is Mona Nelson. She once more showed the surveillance of Nelson dumping Jonathan's burned body, and reminded her that Nelson's DNA was found on his sweatshirt, which was found in the trash outside her apartment. She stated, that is the link. That's why we know this defendant took Jonathan Foster back to her house and killed him. And we'll never know how she killed him, because she burned his body to the point where we can't tell. The prosecutor then held up the welding torch that was found in Nelson's apartment and said, after she did whatever she did to him, she burned every inch of his body with this. She had 4 hours to do it. Judge Jeanine Barr then went off to deliberate, before calling everybody back to court just the next day. She found Mona Nelson guilty of the murder of Jonathan Foster. As the verdict was announced, Nelson stated, I'm innocent. I maintain my innocence. I wouldn't harm anybody. Mona Nelson was then handed an automatic sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole. Jonathan Foster's tumultuous 12 years on earth saw him shuffled between various living situations until he found solace in the home of his uncle. However, this newfound stability was short-lived. Transitioning to live with his mother for the first time in 6 years initially sparked excitement in Jonathan. Unfortunately, that excitement quickly soured due to his mother's new husband. In his final relocation, Jonathan found himself in the clutches of a sadistic child killer. To this day, Mona Nelson claims her innocence, and she is supported by a legion of advocates. Nevertheless, surveillance footage captured her carrying Jonathan's lifeless body to the ditch, where he was ultimately discovered, sealing her fate in the eyes of the law. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening, and I'd like to say a massive thank you to my newest supporter up on Patreon, Felicia. You can join us up on Patreon for as little as $1 a month, and there are absolutely no obligations. You can cancel your subscription at any time. Patreon really helps independent shows such as Morbidology continue, and as a one-woman show, I really do appreciate the support. I upload ad-free and early release episodes, behind the scenes, bonus episodes, and I also send out some handwritten thank you notes along with some Patreon exclusive merch. So if you'd like to join us up on Patreon, the link is in the show notes. If you'd like to support Morbidology in another way, please consider leaving me a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. I really do appreciate the feedback. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.